Good morning, everybody. It's good to see you. We're going to be in Nehemiah 5 today. It's a super cool passage. So if you've got a Bible, go ahead and flip over to Nehemiah 5. We'll also have it up on the screen for those of you who don't have a Bible, and we have them on the front table as a gift if you just don't own a Bible. This passage is going to lift a lot of weight. There's plenty of opportunity for a million little rabbit trails. I did bring it down to maybe 1,000 rabbit trails, and that's all I'm going to do, right? I'm going to try to stay on point as possible. Hey, listen, 2020, I don't know if you remember 2020. Everyone remember 2020? When March came and totally changed how we did life, I know we all learned a little bit about ourselves. That was a season where we kind of got a good long gaze at who we really were as people, but not us as individuals, even as much as society. What does culture look like? It changed the way I saw a lot of things, and I learned a lot of lessons, and I was reminded of a few things. One of the things I was reminded of was mankind's ability to make a buck even when it is inappropriate to make a buck, right? Some of you guys remember the two brothers in Chattanooga that caught the ire of the state's attorney general for going to all of the Dollar Generals and picking up all of the hand sanitizer. Do y'all remember this? And then they were selling them online for up to $80 a bottle, right? They understood supply and demand a little bit better and faster than the rest of us, but it was inappropriate. Super smart, super wrong. I was actually busted in that thing as well. I got caught up in it because I'm on staff with a church. And so the CDC was requiring, hey, it's got to look this certain way once you guys start meeting again. It's got to be clean. I'm talking with our staff. We need to make sure all the toys are clean. I don't know if y'all remember back then, but everything needed to be clean. Everyone's walking around with a fogger and a mister spraying everything with disinfectant. But it was hard to get your hands on even just a surface disinfectant. Now, let me remind you, 6 months earlier, it was $15 for a bottle of Purell surface disinfectant. $15. I happen to have a cousin. I know a guy. I happen to have a cousin who runs and owns a commercial cleaning company in the greater Atlanta area. He does very well. And I called him and I said, hey, listen, what would it take to get my hands on some Purell? He said, you tell me if you find out, man. He's like, because I've been shopping for it all morning, and I'm seeing $250 and $300 a gallon right now, right? That's what we were up against. Now, by God's grace, we found a bunch laying around that we already owned. I'm thankful for that. But, man, those were rough times, weren't they? Toilet paper being black marketed, people selling toilet paper for Bitcoin and ammo, anything you can get. It was tough time. We were all outraged at people taking advantage of such a weird moment in our culture. We weren't really outraged because someone was smart enough to see an opportunity, but because they took it. Even though it meant betrayal and hurting others, we just, as a people, I felt like we lost grasp of the moment at hand, and greed started to run wild. Hey, would it freak you out? I mean, maybe this is anticlimactic because it doesn't freak you out, but would it freak you out to know that this impulse is actually alive in all of us as well? To do something like that, it's alive in you. I mean, greed, which is really what we're talking about, it's hard to see. It's actually camouflaged when we start to look in the mirror and look at ourselves. This is something that Tim Keller has in his book, Counterfeit Gods. He says this, as a pastor, I've had people come to me to confess that they struggle with almost every kind of sin. Almost. I cannot recall anyone ever coming to me and saying, I spend too much money on myself. I think my greedy lust for money is harming my family, my soul, and the people around me. Greed hides itself, he says, from the victim. This is what he's talking about. There are sins like murder or lust that's more binary. It's not so gooey. You know when you've crossed the line. Greed a little bit difficult when we're looking at our own lives. As Keller says, it kind of hides itself. Now, when we're looking at other people, not so much, right? Isn't it easy to see greed in other people's lives? But again, when we look at ourselves, we can't really see it. In fact, we feel like it's almost an impossibility for us to be greedy people. And by the way, we tell ourselves, can't be greedy because we don't have enough to be greedy. We classify that as a struggle for people that are wealthy in things like money or time. But I think if we're being honest with ourselves, when it comes to time or money, and I'm putting those together on purpose. They're both commodities, time and money. They're both very valuable to us. When it comes to those things, greed will find the impoverished just as much as it will find the wealthy. Greed has a voice. It's a very monolithic voice. It says the same thing over and over again. You need a little bit more to be happy. You need a little bit more to be safe. You need just this much more to win. You know, back in the day, this is 100 years ago probably, right around 100 years ago, John D. Rockefeller was the first billionaire ever. And in today's dollars, he was worth just over $30 billion. He would still rank in the top 25 richest men alive, even today. And somebody asked him, how much is enough? I think it was a journalist that caught him on his heels. How much is enough? You know what his answer was? Just a little bit more. Just a little bit more. Now, he was being snarky, okay? Obviously. But he was also nailing it. He's also being very accurate with how greed operates in our life. You see, greed in our life, it doesn't have a finish line. There's no end zone for it. We're always hungering for more and more and more because that's the voice in our head. Greed is the human heart's hunt for more of something that will promise us an ultimate satisfaction today. So this is going to be a helpful passage for us. We really need it to be because real talk between you and me, I think Legacy struggles here. I think we as a church struggle here. I have no metrics to prove that. I just know I struggle with it. And I'm you and you're me. Greed requires constant attention from us. It's not really something that we mature beyond. I also want you to know that today I'm not talking about building a generous moment, but a generous disciple, a lifestyle, really. In other words, I'm not taking a special offering at the conclusion of this service. That's not happening. Sermons that address greed and then have a call to action tied on to the very end of it, that might build a generous moment, but it doesn't mean it builds a generous disciple. Listen, for sure, there's a lot about financial generosity in the Bible. There's a lot about financial generosity just in the book of Nehemiah alone. We're going to touch some of it today. But a moment is not going to build God's things in God's ways. It's going to take a lifetime of generosity to do something like that. And friends, listen, there will be a day. There actually will be a day where we are all called upon as a people to dig deep and be generous. We find a facility, right? That's going to happen. But let me just say this. That's no end zone for us, finding a facility. It's not like that's some white whale that we just can't wait to get. And once we get a facility, everything's going to be fine. We actually have hopes set on much more than that. I only like a facility because it amplifies how fast you can plant churches. I'd like to see more churches plant. I am unsatisfied with how many churches that are being planted. I'd like to see more. I'd like to see more work in the city. I would like to see more nonprofits spun up and sent out. You got to have more than just generous moments. You have to have a generous people for that. Listen, I know it sounds crazy when I say things like that. You might wonder, does Luke really believe that we could change a city? Or is that just something that pastors say? Is that something the pastors are just supposed to say because they're all kind of supposed to believe that we can? Friends, listen, I think we can change a city. Like, I honestly believe that. I'm sold out to that. It takes more than just a generous moment or two. It's going to take generosity in money and in time, but that's going to be our lives. We're not one giving campaign away from some finish line. So I want to look at this passage because I think greed can destroy us. Personally, corporately, and I think it could be harboring and taking up space, and we just can't see it. And I think this passage, again, is going to be very helpful for us. So let's look at Nehemiah 5, verse 1 through 5, and I'm going to stop, and we're going to kind of walk through it a little bit. Again, there's a lot in this text. I'm going to do the best I can to just stay on point, but this is the word of the Lord for us. Nehemiah is going to stop the oppression of the poor in this passage, and it says, "Now there arose a great outcry of the people and of their wives against their Jewish brothers. For there were those who said, 'With our sons and our daughters, we are many. So let us get grain that we may eat and keep alive.' There were also those who said, 'We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses to get grain because of the famine.' And there were those who said, 'We have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. Now our flesh is as the flesh of our brothers. Our children are as their children. Yet we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves. And some of our daughters have already been enslaved. But it is not in our power to help it. for other men have our fields and our vineyards. Okay, that's one scene. There's probably three main scenes in this, just to break it up, just to be helpful. But what's going on here? Nehemiah is encountering this internal outrage that is born of greed. You see, in order for this wall to go up fast, and it is going up very fast, and that's kind of the idea, that's part of the strategy, is not to take their time, but to move quick. In order for this wall to go up so fast, it was siphoning time and energy away from people that had a day job. I mean, if you're a goldsmith, you're not smithing gold all day anymore, whatever that means. You are working on a wall. You're at the horse gate stacking stones. You don't even know what you're doing. You're just doing it because it's got to be done. If you're a perfumer or a merchant, you're spending half of your time at work, I would imagine, and a portion of your time at the wall. But here's the problem with this inability to be at two places at once. You can't eat a wall, and you can't pay your taxes with a wall. And they're in a famine, and grain is already brutal to get your hands on. It's their version of Purell. It costs a lot of money. They can't get their hands on it. So families are even selling their kids into debt slavery. Hear me now. They're selling their kids into debt slavery just to get enough money for grain and to pay taxes. Imagine that for a moment. Imagine selling off one of your kids, right? Just to keep the rest of the family alive. Imagine sitting down and having that discussion with your kids that they're not going to get to have their teenage years with you. Imagine walking through that with your spouse. Imagine the nights of sleep before you sent your kid out the door, never to see them again, just so that you could eat, just so that you could eat. I mean, that's a level of powerlessness I've never experienced before. They felt powerless. What a horrible place to be. And here's an inconvenient fact for these people in this text. They're suffering for obedience. Let's just point right at it. Doing the right thing was impoverishing them. You see, this passage has a mood to it. It's got a vibe to it. These people are thinking, wait, what? We're doing the right thing, though, right? I mean, Nehemiah, you came with a vision, and you spun it out there, and we picked it up because we believe that God is asking you to lead us to build this wall. We think that this is the will of God, and all we've had is a headwind. We don't know what we're doing. I can't work 50, 60 hours at the shop anymore because I'm stuck here doing something I don't know how to do. And we've got enemies outside the wall that are waiting for us to fail. They're letting us know as much. And we've got critics inside that aren't even lifting their amount of weight. And now we're falling victims to our very own brothers. Man, why didn't God just make this easy? Quick question for you. Are you suffering because of obedience? I mean, it's not the main idea of this passage by any means. But it is noteworthy. Maybe you have in the past, maybe you are right now. There's actually a helpful way to look at suffering. We've done a series on suffering. You could find it online. But one of the things we referenced was maybe a rubric of looking at suffering that Paul Miller came up with in a book called The J Curve. It's a great book. He's written a few books. They're all good. But in this, he says you can pretty much classify your suffering in one of four or five ways. One is you did something stupid, right? If you stick a fork in a toaster, you're going to suffer, and that's on you, right? And we're all going to laugh at you if you do that. But the second kind of suffering is somebody else does something stupid, and you pay the price. They're scrolling on their phone, they blast through the stop sign, they T-bone your car, you're suffering, right? That's on them. A third is just creation is broken. Hurricanes, heat waves, poisonous snakes, things like that, right? But a fourth is you obeyed God, and therefore you invited suffering into your life. Consider that for a moment. Because this is why it's important. We often misinterpret suffering. Man, I knew building this wall was stupid. I knew it was a dumb idea. This can't be what God wanted for our lives. And why do we think that? Because it's hard. Because we have a pain point that's being pressed. Because it's difficult. It hurts. Obedience, friends, it's got a headwind. It carries a pain point. It means you can't do the things that your flesh wants to do. The things the human heart really wants to do, we don't. That's what obedience is, and famines aren't going anywhere. Taxes aren't going anywhere. The work has to be done, and God's always going to call us into areas we feel totally incompetent in. I mean, just like the people in this story, obedience will bring friction to your life. So be careful in how you interpret suffering, because listen, you might have invited it. You might have asked for it. If so, God calls you to do something, you step through that door and you find a wall after a wall after wall after problem after problem. This is what you need to know. God is close by. He will give you what you need because he does not break his promises. And it might not even mean what you think it means in the moment. I hear people tell others who are suffering sometimes, listen, God is close by. He's going to make everything well for you. Well, what do you mean when you say well? Because if you look back in history, you have men and women who were martyrs who stepped into obedience and they were evangelists or church planters or they just loved Jesus and they were killed by the sword, by the masses, buried in graves that have no tombstone to them. We've long forgotten their names and they obeyed God. Was God close by then? Yes. Even closer. They blinked and they found paradise. He does not break his promises. Friend, the truth is your worst problem has already been solved because another person obeyed and found a headwind. Because another obeyed and found pain. Because another one stepped into the path of the gospel and found trouble. Let's look at verse 6. Let's go into verse 6. Because that's their mood, but then Nehemiah carries a mood himself. He says, I was very angry when I heard their outcry and these words. I took counsel with myself, and I brought charges against the nobles and the officials. I said to them, you are exacting interest, each from his brother, and I held a great assembly against them. Okay, says he was very angry. Behind the language there, if you were to kind of scratch the surface of that language to find out what it originally meant, it means he's burned down inside. Inside he is burning up with rage and with anger. And so it says he took counsel with himself. We know what that means without knowing what that means. He took a beat. He took a minute. And he found his right mind so that he would have some semblance of control whenever he addressed the nobles. I heard recently at a conference something that I've heard growing up, and it is how we handle our emotions, specifically anger. Emotions, the way the saying goes, emotions are like kids on a car trip, right? A road trip. You don't let them drive the car, but you can't put them in the trunk either, right? They have to be passengers. This is especially true with anger. You cannot stuff it down, right? You can, but that's going to get you some ulcer medication later in life and a bunch of money at a counselor. You keep stuffing it down. There's ramifications for that. But you can't just give it the wheel either and just take the filter off and just let anger run free. This is also not the main idea of the passage, but I think we can still learn quite a bit about how to operate inside of anger. Because anger is not always a sin. Sometimes it's actually a sin to not be angry. We've talked about that as well. An unaffected heart that is not angry, that's not always a righteous thing, right? But to the angry in the room, and you know who you are. You know who you are. Those who get there fast, right? If you're confused, ask somebody who loves you the most, and they will tell you, yes, you are that person. You are an angry person. Isn't it true that you cannot figure out why everyone else around you is not affected the way that you are? You're almost enraged because nobody else is enraged. Feels lonely, doesn't it? Here's a warning for you. You can be rightfully angry and wrongfully exercise that anger. That's possible. You're right. There's plenty wrong with the world. There's plenty for you to be angry at what we're doing to our kids through abortion or hormone therapy or surgical alterations or you name it, or where we see corruption, whether it's city council or the pulpit or the White House or on and on. We see all kinds of things that make us angry, and they should. But this is no reason to become offensive to non-Christians. I see this so much. Election years are the worst for this. It is no reason to become offensive to non-Christians who are only different from you in one way, that God's grace has given you the Holy Spirit, which has changed your heart. Think about that. If it wasn't for the Spirit of God that came by the grace of God, you're just like them, unable to change, unable to even see correctly. So why would we behave like Pharisees who sneer down our noses over those who have no Spirit of God in them, honestly? And your battle's not against flesh and blood anyway. But I know what the angry heart is thinking. Luke, if I don't say it, I'm just going to keep burning down inside. It's bubbling up. It's like lava. If I don't say it, I'm just going to be angry. Oh, so say it. Say it then. Just don't sin in doing so. Take counsel with yourself. Maybe take counsel with others too before you bring charges. Because you know as well as I do, angry person, anger has a hard time finding the brake pedal. I often see people explode in anger, especially online, and then they take cover under some magic cloak of righteousness. It's okay that I said something rude. It's okay that I said something wrong because I feel like I'm right, and the Bible does have this one passage, so I'm just going to go ahead and lay it out there. And I don't care how it makes anyone feel. Congrats, you said what was right, and you said it wrongly. And now, people can't see the gospel through six layers of jerk. They can't. They can't see Christ in your constant trashing online, constant venting online. Take counsel. Take counsel, because here's the thing. You're not more upset than Nehemiah was in this moment. I don't know what it is you're angry at, but you're not more upset than he is right now. He took counsel. He collected himself. He built a charge. He brilliantly brought it through a measured amount of anger that was God glorifying, right? Let's move on. That's just the first scene. The others move quicker. Let's look in verse 8. And he said to them, he held a great assembly against them and said to them, we, as far as we are able, have bought back our Jewish brothers who have been sold to the nations. But you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us. They were silent and could not find a word to say. So I said, the thing that you are doing is not good. Ought you not to walk in the fear of our God to prevent the taunts of the nations of our enemies? Moreover, I and my brothers and my servants are lending them money and grain. Let us abandon this exacting of interest. Return to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive orchards, and their houses, and the percentage of the money, grain, wine, and oil that you have been exacting from them. Then they said, we will. We will restore these and require nothing from them. We will do as you say. And I called the priests and made them swear to do as they had promised. I also shook out the fold of my garment and said, so may God shake out every man from his house and from his labor who does not keep this promise. So may he be shaken out and emptied. And all the assembly said, amen, and praise the Lord. And the people did as they had promised. This is a really cool scene right here. The problem was that there were people increasing in their trials by treating this like a business transaction. They saw an opportunity and they took it. Again, selling Purell is not wrong. Understanding supply and demand is not wrong. You can go to college for it, be very good at it. Gouging in a pandemic, though, is wrong. And that's what we have right here. There is this conversation around slavery and whether the Bible is pro-slavery or not. This is a passage that a lot in that argument will attach themselves to. Again, it's a rabbit trail I'd love to go down. I wrote two blogs on it. One of them I just wrote, and one's a little older. You can go to our website, scroll down, and read it on whether the Bible is pro-slavery or not. Here's the punchline. It's not. But it's good for you to know why some things are in the Bible. The main idea that I'm going to keep trying to come back to is that this was a moment that is not to be treated as business as usual, because it's not a usual moment. It's a different cultural moment. The cultural moment called for the casting aside of privileges to build the wall. This moment called for generous hospitality, not greed, right? He says, this thing you are doing is not good. They had betrayed brotherhood into slavery. They endangered the economic infrastructure and the wall even getting built. And so he brings an appropriate anger and says, can we see how this is not God glorifying? And all the other nations are laughing at us? Can we see how this is just not working? How this is bad at its very core? How you're working against what we know from Deuteronomy and Leviticus? How we're breaking things with our hands? And they said, yeah, we can see it. And so they reversed course. Imagine that. Kids went home that day. Ooh. Can you imagine the tears of joy as your 13-year-old walks back in that you thought you weren't going to get to see again? How you walk into your kitchen and there's grain and there's food and your family's not going to starve? Man, this is a big moment. It's buried in the text, but this is a huge moment for a nation like this. Let's look at verse 14. Moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of Artaxerxes the king, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the food allowance of the governor. The former governors who were before me laid heavy burdens on the people and took from them for their daily ration 40 shekels of silver. Even their servants lorded it over the people, but I did not do so because of the fear of God. I also persevered in the work on this wall, and we acquired no land. And all my servants were gathered there for the work. Moreover, there were at my table 150 men, Jews and officials, besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. Now, what was prepared at my expense for each day was one ox and six choice sheep and birds, and every 10 days all kinds of wine in abundance. Yet for all this, I did not demand the food allowance of the governor because the service was too heavy on the people. Remember for my good, O my God, all that I have done for this people. All right, scene three. Like all governors that came before him, Nehemiah had access to a large expense account that was supported by the tax base. It's not anything weird. It's probably to be expected, but he refused it because he did not want to burden the people there. He did not, however, cancel those big dinners. He kept those. That's interesting to me, right? We're not talking about he got a lot at Chick-fil-A. We're talking about a very different kind. It's a banquet. Every night was a banquet. I did the math, 4,380 of these. His oxen would have been 4,380 oxen. That's over 3 million pounds of meat over the 12 years. Over 26,000 goats and over 250,000 bottles of wine. That's the best estimates of what he paid out of his own paycheck. And this isn't the paycheck that he took from the tax base. This is what he already had. This is sacrificial. He did not stop the banquets, but he did not pass the buck either. He covered it himself. This stands in direct contrast to the greedy lenders that we just got done reading about. You're supposed to see that. That contrast is for us. Here's what we see. This is why this is in your Bible. Nehemiah took the opportunity to impoverish himself to benefit others who, when those same people did, they took the opportunity to enrich themselves at the cost of others. Does this shape sound familiar to you? You're supposed to see it, because hundreds of years later, Jesus would impoverish himself to do what? To be hospitable to greedy and broke people, especially those who would be greedy to those who were in need. Whenever you see this beautiful moment of Jesus being hospitable to you and me, particularly in the end of all ends, when we will also, as his people, sit at a banqueting table that we have no business sitting at a chair waiting for us, it will never be pulled out from underneath us, a space of belonging for you and me for eternity, this beautiful picture of hospitality, it's the beautiful version of this, where we just see Nehemiah building a great banqueting table for what? For the people that were enslaving others, broken people, dirty people, those who are only in it for themselves. Greed is nowhere to be found in such hospitality. This is what amazes a watching world. This, because it's mystifying. But it's important to know that this generous hospitality, it took a toll on Nehemiah. We have proof of it because he says, remember this, God. Remember this. I'm remembering it because I'm writing the check every week. It's expensive what I'm doing to be hospitable to villains, to greedy people, to broken people, to needy people, every single day. Hundreds of years later, Jesus would come and he would give even deeper. He would give his very last breath for villains. 2 Corinthians 8, though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor so that you, by his poverty, might become rich. You know what's cool? Is after Jesus came, was a carpenter, was just a brother, a son. After he started his ministry and did miracles and taught brilliant things and laughed and loved and gave, after he died, after he was resurrected, after he ascended to the right hand of God, after the church started, after the church grew, they would go back and read the exact same words that you and I just read. They'd read the same thing, and they would see a shadow of a much more brilliant light, provoking them and hopefully provoking us to say, look at our God, our true host, significantly giving of his own account, sacrificially giving from his own account. For who? For the greedy, the broken, the needy. See, God's hospitality, it creates space at a table for far more than just 150 officials, but for you and for me. And we'll be bigger than all the amount of sand that could ever be counted on any seashore. Let me tell you something else you're supposed to see in this passage. Nehemiah was wealthy. Hey, listen, it's okay to be wealthy. Can we talk about this for a moment? We see zero evidence right now of Nehemiah lamenting his wealth. We see zero evidence of him feeling guilty for his wealth. He worked hard at the wall, he was immensely wealthy, and he willingly surrendered his privileges and his wealth. The church can be very good at eating its rich, which is odd to me for some reason. I mean, let's be honest, there are far more economical ways for Nehemiah to feed 150 people, right? There was far better ways of doing this. But he didn't. He didn't. Let me ask you this question. Would you feel guilty if you were given $1 million? Somebody hands you a suitcase, it's after taxes, you have $1 million. Would you feel guilty? What about 10 million? Would you feel guilty for that? This is a real question. I know many people who do feel guilty for their wealth. And so I think what we'll do when we encounter moments like that, questions like that, is we'll say, I wouldn't feel guilty because I just give most of it away. I would never live in a really, really nice house, or I'd never really drive a nice car. Listen, I think this deserves more airtime, things like this. I can't go super into it, but I just wanted to point your attention back to Nehemiah. He had an abundance of wine, and yet there are poor people in the land. He had immense wealth, and yet there was no guilt expressed in this. Friends, listen, if we recognize the sovereignty of God in making some rich and some not rich, we would see wealth as more of a blessing than a sin. I mean, we have God saying through Psalm 24 that the earth and everything in it belongs to the Lord. It's all his. He gives to some, and then he doesn't give to others. He does it according to his sovereign will, and we can't understand it. 1 Samuel 2, it says, the Lord makes poor, and the Lord makes rich. And we see this, don't we? Don't you just see or read about people in the news, and you think, that guy is filthy rich, and he's not that bright. He's not even that gifted. He just kind of got it. I can't even figure out why he's so wealthy. Maybe his great uncle invented some widget that you own, and so he just passed it on to his nephew two generations down. Maybe it's somebody that just kind of was at the right place at the right time. Doesn't it ever mystify you? How did that guy, that gal, that family make so much? And what about this truly talented couple, this guy, that gal, and they can't make anything? Some try as hard as they can to make themselves rich, and they cannot seem to do it. Some try to make themselves poor, and they cannot seem to do it. If God makes some wealthy and God makes others poor, then we have as much control over it as we do the parents we were stuck with. And I do not feel guilty about the way I was raised or the parents that were given to me. Nor do I feel guilty about the country I grew up in that I had no say over, but was under the control of a sovereign God. Friend, if you steward your money as a blessing and exercise it to advance the gospel through the church, you should not feel guilty about the fact you're wealthy. You're blessed, friend, with wealth. You're blessed. Responsible for it, with great responsibility, not to sound like Spider-Man's uncle or anything like that, but with great wealth comes great responsibility. But you are blessed. Nehemiah is as generous as he is wealthy. He takes responsibility and he stewards his wealth. That's what we have here. Again, for some reason, it's popular to hate the wealthy. But I want you to be careful about what's crafting that worldview in your head if you struggle with that. Is it a bitterness? Is it an envy? Is it an insecurity? Is it the culture? Don't let the culture craft your narrative. Again, this is not the main idea of the passage. Greed and generosity, however, affecting what God is building is. How you and I handle time and money, it tells the story of how we fear God and love each other. And we're often bent in the shape of preferring ourselves over others. And I think this is where this passage finds me. I think it's where it finds me most bent, right? you do not have to despise other people in order to exercise greed. You just need to love something more than you love God. You don't have to hate the person next to you or across the room. You just need to love something more than God. And we're all bent in this shape that when our feet hit the floor every morning, we don't see it, we don't hear it, but it's this natural posture of me over you. I'm on board with all of this, but ultimately it's going to be me over you. I'm okay with this family, but it's going to be me above the family. I'm okay with this job, but it's me above the job. I'm okay with this church, but it's going to be me above everybody. It's me over you. Man, listen, that's all we need to ruin each other, not a hate for each other, just greed. We can look around at the work to be done, God's work and God's ways, and we can say, hey, listen, I'm on board with all that because it sounds pretty good, but I'm always going to look out for number one, me over you, with my time, with my money, with my everything. I don't know if any, I'm older than most of the people in here, but I don't know if you've ever done this, but if you've ever moved a hot tub before, okay? If you've ever gotten one of those phone calls, hey, can you help me move a hot tub? If you haven't, this is what you can be ready for. It's the heaviest thing God has ever made. There's no heavier thing in the world than that. And there's nothing to hold on to. It's just the sharp edge. You know, you have the sharp edge. Doesn't matter how many gloves you have on. And it takes so many dudes, you're like shoulder to shoulder. It's a little bit of a choreographed shuffle to get a hot tub from, this is after we've emptied all the water, right? Some of you are like, dude, I know what your problem is. You got to take the water out first. It's heavy with no water. But there's always one guy. You know what I'm going to say? There's always one guy that's just not really lifting. He's in the corner. He's faking it. He's even grunting a little bit. He's not fooling anybody. He's not trying. He's holding back. He's barely lifting. Listen, the church is full of people like this. We're all moving a hot tub. They're making the sounds. They showed up. They're going through the motions. But really, me over you. Greed in me and greed in you will create disunity in this thing that God has built with the blood of his son. It will slow the mission. It will break the infrastructure of the church and the mission that we are called to build. It demands repentance. It demands, listen, this is a sermon we try really hard to hear for other people. But how often do you assess your own greed and repent for it? How often do you do that? I've had to ask myself that question all week. I think it's something that we can do today. Here's the good news for you and me. Nothing will remedy a greedy heart like a generous Jesus. I don't need more. This is the beauty. This is the ramification of the gospel in my life. I don't need any more. That silence is that voice of greed in my life. I don't need another dollar. I don't need another minute. I don't need another Saturday. He is greater than all of life. He is all that I need. And because he has increased me with every spiritual blessing in the heavenlies, I'm free to lay aside all of my privileges, whatever the moment calls for. I'm free to spend myself. I'm free to impoverish myself. I'm free to empty myself, to decrease. Why? Because Jesus has brought me to a banqueting table again. He's grafted me into a family dinner. I have no business being in. I was a criminal. I was a greedy criminal, not even looking for him. Happy to take use of any opportunity given to me to increase me over everyone. That's how he found me. And then he doesn't just invite me into the room. He brings me into the family, sits me at a table and says, here's your chair. It will never be taken from you. I'm free. He's provided everything. Friend, we have so much work before us. If you choose to build, we have so much to build. There is so much on the line, life and death. I think our challenge is to look at our heart. Is it generous or does it struggle with greed? Look at your calendar. Look at your expenses. What does it disclose? What tale does it tell about your fears and your loves? And then again, the good news of nothing is going to remedy that greed like a generous Jesus does. And listen, I know some of you were here. You're far from God. I know before Jesus wrecked me for anything else, the one passage, and it wasn't like I was some Bible scholar, but there was one passage that really gripped me, and it was where Jesus says, it's in Matthew 11, is where Jesus says, come to me, all who are weary. I mean, it doesn't matter how long you've been in the Lord. Isn't that such a beautiful passage? Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, tired, broken, fatigued, regretful. Come to me, all who are weary, and I will give you rest. His yoke is built differently than ours. There's so much for him to teach us. He is gentle. He is lonely. It's a fantastic passage. But what does he mean, weary? Come to me, all who are weary. Weary of what? Weary of trying to fill that massive hole in your life? Sure. Weary of maybe running through every addiction, after looking for some sort of soul set? Sure. But also there's a soul weariness from just failed obedience, just trying to be cleaner, trying to look more impressive. That we get blasted with weariness, just trying to be a better version of ourselves without Christ. Maybe that's where you feel enslaved and trapped. Working so hard to impress God, working so hard to do the right things to the right scale that you have felt trapped in a system of behavior that you can't operate. I've been there. I get it. Listen, give yourself, this is my submission to you, fall at the feet, submit your life, fall hard behind the one who did obey, the one who did plow, the one who is impressive, the one who did follow all of the law, the one who came to build a better banqueting table. Follow Christ. You don't have to. You could leave today, and you can just try again on Monday. Just try extra hard. I mean, just give it another shot, right? Try to be cleaner. Try not to cuss. Try to drive the speed limit. Give to a charity. Try to encourage somebody. Do whatever you need to do. Give it a shot on Monday. Listen, if it doesn't work, it's okay. Try even harder the next Monday. Just keep trying. Just keep trying. Eventually, you're going to get weary, right? You might already be there. Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden and tired and fatigued from just trying to do life right. He will give you rest. For the rest of us, God's people, fix your gaze on a generous Jesus today and let him heal your greedy heart.